Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armodian. In this hour, massive earthquakes in Turkey and Syria have killed thousands of people. How have the disaster relief efforts complied with legal requirements under international law? Doug Becker explores.
I'm Doug Becker. On February 6th, 2023, a massive 7.8 earthquake hit Turkey and Syria. Multiple tremors, including some as intense as 7.0, continue to hit the region, and the resulting damage has been utterly devastating. We record this on February 16th, and as of today, over 35,000 people have been killed in this earthquake. On today's show, we will examine the response to the earthquake. We will focus on the specific campaign to save lives, begin the cleanup, and also the criticisms that some of the governments, particularly the Turkish government, has been, shall we say, less effective than it should have been. We will focus on the types of challenges such a disaster poses in the response of political and humanitarian actors. And we will examine the legal framework for international action in providing resources and expertise to the region, particularly in light of the ongoing war in Syria. Our panel today are Nuket Sandal. She's Associate Professor of Political Science and Associate Dean in the College of Arts and Sciences at Ohio University. She's the author of Religious Populist Parties, Nationalisms, and Strategies of Competition, The Case of the AK Party in Turkey, and Religious Leaders and Conflict Transformation. She's also the Editor-in-Chief of the Oxford Research Encyclopedia of International Studies. Andrea De Guttre is Professor of International Law at Scuola Superior Santa Anna, or SSSA, in Pisa, Italy. He's the author of Foreign Fighters Under International Law and International Disaster Response Law. And Brenda Knoll, who is full professor at the School of Public and International Affairs at North Carolina State University. She is the author of Public Management in an Era of the Unprecedented, Dominant Institutional Logics as a Barrier to Organizational Sensemaking, and the Structure of Effective Governance of Disaster Response Networks, Insights from the Field. Thank you all very much for joining us today. Nuket Sandal, we'll start with you. You have quite a bit of knowledge about internally, you know, about Turkish politics and the Turkish response to this disaster. Can you update us as to, you know, as to that response and at least kind of an initial reaction to how effective has Turkey been at responding to this crisis?
Thank you very much, Doug. Yes, this has been a really difficult week for all of us who are following the news from Turkey. Like you mentioned, currently the official figures for Turkey are more than 35,000, although I have been in touch with some colleagues who are on the ground who say that the real damage will probably is around like 100,000 people who will be killed by this tragedy. More than 50,000 buildings have collapsed, which is a terrifying number given the cold and rain in the region, which makes rescue efforts even more difficult. More than 14 million people are affected. And the confirmed deaths at this point has surpassed the massive Erzincan earthquake in 1939. So we are looking at a grim picture. And like you said, Turkish government response has been lacking in multiple respects. President Recep Tayyip Erdogan has admitted that the first day we had this conference, but he insisted that they are in control right now and the regions that need help have been reached and things are going well. But it is people from the ground, journalists, officials report that this is far from being the truth. There are still many buildings that have not been, there are many towns, counties that have not been even reached yet. And as we know, after the fourth, fifth day, although we have some miracles, It's very difficult. I mean, it's almost impossible to have more rescue operations. So given that the region is one of the most earthquake prone regions in the world, as you know, like it lies in a territory where the three tectonic plates meet. And this was expected, and we can talk more about this later in the show, but the Turkish government has been collecting even like an earthquake tax from its citizens, which they say should amount at this point to more than $3 billion. So one would expect Turkey, one, these regions to be more prepared, these buildings to be more in line with the strict building regulations, and also the rescue efforts being more efficient, or the military being mobilized in such a huge disaster. So we haven't seen that, and the government has been criticized by many Turkish citizens, and these areas hit by the earthquake are mostly AK Party electorate. So that also raises some questions about the elections in May. We will come there later, but I just at this point would like to confirm that yes, there is a lot of challenges Turkish government facing. This is definitely an unexpected disaster, but there is also a significant human error when it comes to preparations and also the rescue efforts.
And Brandon Noll, Nukhet referenced efficient and effective responses to disasters like this. Big, broad question. What would an efficient response to a disaster like this, what are some of the principles that should guide making it most efficient and most effective?
Absolutely. Well, I mean, you know, there's a general rubric that I think follows all disasters, which protection and preservation of life is always on the top of it. And so trying to minimize casualties as much as possible once the disaster has already happened. So not talking about the mitigation phase of things in terms of trying to, you know, most of the work needs to be done ahead of time in terms of doing that. But once something like this happens, really the first priority and for the initial and what we call kind of initial and extended attack on what's happening is going to be around preservation of life. So it's trying to get people out of buildings and you know, safe, getting them out of the cold since it's in the wintertime, getting them food, getting them shelter, you know, getting people, families. Oftentimes we have children that get separated from families during things like this. And so trying to get people reunited back with their networks so that they can support themselves and take care of their loved ones. That's always the first round. And then you go to the stuff that's required in the sort of second order, which is going to be debris removal and trying to restore the infrastructure, the utilities, the power, water, sewer systems, all of those that are required to sustain life, and then sort of ongoing economic and social, cultural consequences of these things then go on for years after that. But that's pretty much a standard, you know, in terms of what effectiveness looks like, is that we minimize the casualties as much as possible, and, you know, preserve life and minimize injuries. And then we get folks stabilized in for the short term, and then we start to rebuild and get people into more mid and long-term solutions that are stable.
Yeah. And actually to follow up, Brandon Noll, it seems like one fairly constant development in these kinds of natural disasters, when you reference things like sewers and, you know, fresh water, et cetera, that disease can often follow this. And that whenever I think of earthquakes and the destruction of infrastructure like this, one of my immediate concerns is always cholera and other waterborne diseases. I guess, where does that figure in? I mean, at one level, getting bodies out of buildings, getting people out of buildings is essential, but how quickly issues like managing disease figure in?
It really highlights what's a very common thing, it seems, across all disasters, but particularly in these what we call catastrophic ones that have exceeded our local response capability, where, you know, you start to see these sort of systemic failures and inability to respond in the way that we would expect response would happen. We would expect within 24 hours that we were able to get people out of buildings, and or 48 hours at the most, and those sorts of things. So when things have overwhelmed our ability to do that, Then, you know, you really see this sort of tiered thing happening where oftentimes we get so focused on the elongated initial phase that we forget that there's all these downstream things that are about to start happening as well. People don't have food, people don't have water, it's cold outside, there's not sanitation, there's all those sorts of things. So it really does require, the folks who are in leadership positions on the response to have sort of different folks focused on different aspect in terms of the temporal ordering of how this is going to play out and what are some of the downstream problems that are going to need to get solved, right? I think it becomes very clear right after an incident like this that, you know, trying to get people out of buildings and out of the rubble becomes sort of this dominating idea. But it's important to have, you know, a part of the system thinking about what are some of the downstream needs and starting to get that stuff staged. And we see this all the time. You know, we know response capability requires, the one element of is the mitigation, like how much are we going to need to respond based on, you know, how much damage is the incident going to do? And then the second is our response capability. And how fast can we mobilize that? Everything takes time to mobilize. It's not, you know, it takes time to get trucks out. It takes time to get the debris removal, especially at this scale, in terms of where to put all of that stuff. It takes time to get new water systems put back in. Everything takes time to mobilize. And so really having, a tiered response where you've got strategic leadership at from day one, you know, at day one, somebody, you know, there needs to be groups of folks who are really strategically thinking about not day one and what needs to happen, but what needs to happen on day five and what needs to happen on day 10 and what needs to happen on day 15 and 2 months from now and 3 months from, like, starting to really think through and staging that stuff ahead of time, because all of that stuff is going to take time, and all of it's going to take way more time in this type of situation than it would normally because of the fact that all of the infrastructure is interrupted. And so you're going to have to re-engineer around a whole lot of things. And so that element of time is so, so critical, both in the immediate stuff, which is what we think about, but also in this long-term stuff. We can make things a lot better or a lot worse, depending on how fast we can start mobilizing some of the downstream response efforts as well.
Absolutely. And Andrea DeGuttrie, I want to bring you in as well to talk about some of the international responses, because a lot of the emphasis here has been on domestic responses. And of course, this really devastated two different countries with very different capacities, very different levels of resources. Turkey, obviously, better prepared, although perhaps not completely prepared for this, but Syria being completely devastated. What are some of the international responsibilities and international legal principles for states outside of the region being able to provide resources, required to provide the resources? Is there a way in which the resources are delivered from a legal framework?
Once upon a time, international law is pretty clear and has very clear-cut rules. There is another problem if they are respected, but this is another issue. Basically, one of the principles is that the state where the disaster happened has the main responsibility of taking care. Branda was highlighting this. Let me just add one comment. This is not only an ethical or a moral obligation of the state to help their citizens or whomever is suffering the consequences, but it is a legal obligation. And I am underlining this because what could happen, especially in the case of Turkey, who is a member of the Council of Europe, in which there is a human rights treaty, that those who are suffering the consequences of the earthquake and who feel that the state has not done enough, as Branda and Nuket were underlining, probably there are some delays, they could bring in front of a court, first of all in Turkey, and then the court in Strasbourg, saying that the state has not implemented this obligation. And there are already cases of this nature. And as you can imagine, the court in Strasbourg, they tend to sympathize a little bit to those who have suffered the consequences, and they request quite a lot of very clear indications about what the state has done to prevent this happening or to mitigate the consequences or to respond in an effective manner. But having said this, The first rule is the state is responsible. The second rule is, and I think that this happens in both cases, if the state, due to the magnitude of the event, is unable to deal with the situation, which may happen, and it happened in the case of Turkey, because the disaster was so big that they could not really solve the problem, the state has an obligation, once more, sorry for being a little bit legalistic, an obligation to call for international assistance. And this happened in the case of Turkey, not in the case of Syria. Now, if the state doesn't request international assistance, then the state is committing another serious violation of international law, which could have consequences at international law. But let me now just briefly separate the two problems. Turkey has requested international assistance quite quickly. And as you may know, one of the first mechanisms which Turkey has requested to be activated is the Union Civil Protection Mechanism, which is a framework in the European Union, which is conceived to support states of the European Union and the so-called participating states, which are states close to the area of the European Union, to ask. And there is a whole mechanism through which this assistance is provided. And I have to say that Turkey has fulfilled this obligation they have requested. And now the last question is, two-third states have an obligation to answer positively to this request coming from one state who has been obliged to make this request because he was unable to deal with this. The answer is once more very clear, at least from a legal point of view. State do not have an obligation, we are speaking of legal obligation, to support the state. Something different is moral and political obligation, but it's something different. They do not have a legal obligation unless they are part of a treaty, which could be a regional or bilateral treaty, which states the contrary. And in the EU, it is one of the few examples in the European Union for the EU member states. So this doesn't apply in the specific case of Turkey. For the European Union member states, if there is a request, the other states of the European Union have an obligation to support, to do whatever they can in that given moment to support the states. So to sum up, there are rules, they are very clear. The problem is to make sure that they are enforced, but there are as well mechanisms to guarantee their proper functioning.
And you're listening to Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Doug Becker. We're discussing the ongoing challenges of disaster relief following the massive earthquake that hit Turkey and Syria with Nukhet Sandal of Ohio University, Andrea De Guitry of SSSA in Pisa, Italy, and Brendan Knoll of North Carolina State University. Andrea, I want to follow this up. In international relations, there's this ongoing development of this norm that we'll call responsibility to protect, or R2P. Now, it's a norm, it's certainly not a legal obligation per se, so you might categorize it as a political, you know, maybe ethical question. But since that development around the year 2000, has the legal framework creating obligations for states, or at least pressures on states to intervene, increased at all? Or has it been pretty ineffective at trying to create that obligation?
You will be surprised by my answer, but strange enough, the system has evolved. And the mechanisms to make this rule, this obligation to ask for international cooperation if you are unable to cope with the disaster, have become more and more effective. I give you two examples. The UN Security Council, in a situation which is slightly different, but at the end it's pretty similar, declared that if a state is unable or unwilling to prevent this happening, and there are hundreds or thousands, or as Nukhet was telling us, even 100,000 possibly people who are suffering the consequences of this inability of the state to do something. So if the state is unable or unwilling and does not request international assistance, the UN could authorize a so-called operation, military operation, to bring in with the force the support, the humanitarian support, which is necessary for the provision of humanitarian aid, which is requested. Now, this is not the case of Turkey, because Turkey has been very openly requesting international assistance, but this might be the case of Syria, which for a long period, I mean long considering the emergency situation, has denied the access of humanitarian aid to the affected regions, and is continuing nowadays not to deny, but to make it de facto impossible to provide assistance in given areas which are not 100% under the control of the Syrian authorities. Let me just finish adding one other comment to prove the effectiveness of this rule. If the Security Council doesn't allow or authorize these kind of military operations, which might happen due to the exercise of the veto right in the UN Security Council, member states have started to create a practice which is now becoming, no, I don't want to say popular, but basically accepted, which is in the so-called, it is the so-called humanitarian intervention. That is to say that states individually, without any blessing of the United Nations Security Council, can do a military operation to stop the situation in a given country which doesn't allow this. There are a few cases even related to natural disaster. I would like to remember what happened or what has been threatened to happen in Myanmar after the tsunami, which hit as well the coast of Myanmar, but Myanmar was denying that this was affecting them, but it was clearly affecting, and Myanmar was not in a position to help its citizens, and the international community threatened to do a so-called humanitarian operation, which is a military operation against the state who does not allow me to bring the necessary humanitarian support to the local population. So the rules are there. The mechanism for enforcing them is there and is becoming more effective. Now, the last problem is, are the states really willing to use them? Because obviously, it depends from the states to decide if they want to use this mechanism, yes or no. If they don't want to use it, obviously the mechanisms are there, but they won't be used.
Now, Nuket, this issue of the requests for international assistance and access, I was listening yesterday, you know, to an interview with an American representative who kept insisting that the U.S. is not blocking any aid to Syria. Didn't list anybody explicitly who was, but the reports are that aid's not getting to Syria. Is Turkey blocking aid to Syria? I know that's been some of the rumors out there. Do you have any sort of insights as to Turkey's relationship with Syria and aid flowing into Syria?
Well, that's a great question, Doug, and it's really difficult to give a concrete answer to that. But it is quite possible for various reasons. First of all, of course, Turkey has its own issues to deal with right now. And unfortunately, we also receive reports that this disaster consolidated some of the hate crimes and prejudice against the Syrians in the region. There are multiple disturbing like snapshots we see. So there is a high level of prejudice against the Syrians, even among the regular folks in those bordering cities. So unfortunately, we cannot imagine a situation where an earthquake affected city region people are rushing to make sure that the aid is crossing the border and going to places where it should go. And of course, this is made even more difficult by all the logistical issues surrounding the crossings. And I'm sure Andrea can speak more to those issues and legal debates as well. But until very recently, there was only one crossing that was going to Syria, and it was badly damaged. I mean, I have seen some photos myself, and it's almost impossible to imagine a large volume of aid going through Bab al-Hawa. So later, very recently, two other crossings have opened. Things are not smooth still. There are, again, like this is not an area that has a clear governance structures. There are NGOs operating on the ground, but there are multiple actors in the region. And that has been one of the challenges of controlling who gets the aid, who distributes the aid. Those are also exacerbating factors in addition to a possible Turkish reluctance to make the transition smooth.
Brenda Noel, then, that raises this question. I know you write about disaster response networks. Kind of have two questions. I'll ask this first one. There's always been concerns about the fragmentation of response, that different groups are working on sort of different issues and who's actually responsible for organizing the response in a way, which then creates obviously prioritizations for that. So I guess, I mean, the first question is how much of a challenge and how much sort of broadly in disaster relief, is this a challenge and how has it been overcome? Particularly if it's a case like in Syria where, you know, you imagine the state should be the one organizing the priority, but if the state's pretty, you know, pretty weak. And then I'll have a follow-up question with, you know, with that as well, but we'll start with that one.
Sure. Absolutely. Well, I think, you know, I think there's two root issues that, you know, depending on which one is present, creates a slightly different problem. And one of them is that you've got sort of a top-down system that is trying to maintain control of what's going on and is being overwhelmed, but is too slow to recognize that it's overwhelmed. And so its system isn't adapting fast enough to allow actors who could come in and be useful during those windows to do it in as timely a fashion as they could. So that's one problem, is when you've got a system that is supposed to be in place and is supposed to be responsible and is overwhelmed in terms of it is beyond its capacity to respond to the needs, and it doesn't really have a good process for decentralizing that response and devolving that responsibility across into a networked more of a response. So that's one problem. The other problem that you're talking about is where there actually isn't sort of anyone on first in terms of somebody who's the point person, like, oh, this is the person who would tell me where I go or how to go and set priorities and set the grid and make sure that, you know, we're not duplicating efforts and that, you know, everybody's getting covered. There's coverage in all of the zones and all this sort of stuff. If you don't have that, then you have a lot of responders who are coming in but there's no overarching infrastructure to sort of help coordinate them and making sure. So you get a lot of response happening oftentimes in the areas that are easier to get to. I was just actually reading some stuff where they were talking about, you know, buildings were getting targeted based on where they'd found some survivors. So, you know, there was sort of a random, it wasn't random, it was basically that, you know, like where they, somebody had a tweet and that where all the response then went, and it focused around on that one building as opposed to moving out across the region and maybe canvassing in a little more systematic way. So things get much more chaotic and you can end up with a lot of redundancy and a less efficient response in that context because of the fact that you don't have the sort of overarching platform that allows everybody to sort of know what everybody else is doing and find where they, you know, find their niche within that. So they're two different problems. Sometimes they can exist, you know, pseudo simultaneously.
When we come back, international law gives guidance on disaster relief efforts and security in the disaster zone. What does it tell us about the latest deadly earthquake in Turkey and Syria? Stay with us. This is the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. Who is responsible for security in disaster zones? What happens when the state's security capacity is also devastated by the disaster? Doug Becker explores.
I'm Doug Becker. Our guests today are Nuket Sandal, who is Associate Professor of Political Science and the Associate Dean of the College of Arts and Sciences at Ohio University. Andrea Dugutri, who is Professor of International Law at SSSA in Pisa, Italy. And Brandon Knoll, Professor in the School of Public and International Affairs at North Carolina State University. So, Brandon Knoll, one of the big concerns is security. Security for those on the ground who are doing the work in the international versus domestic or outside versus, you know, inside. And then the people who actually have lived there, not just the insecurity of an earthquake and buildings falling, but general, you know, increases in crime, violent crime, those sorts of questions. Who's responsible for that security and how high on the priority list typically is the security of the local population in response to some of these other issues?
So this is where I'm at a disadvantage because, and Andrea probably has more insight into this, because security, at least in domestic context in the United States, is a highly decentralized activity. So it is the jurisdictional authority of the local law enforcement resources. And so other security forces need to come in coordination and with permission from those local forces, which has generally been a big problem in the context of disasters, because it's oftentimes those local forces have been overwhelmed and they themselves are victims of the disaster. So, you know, their buildings may be gone. They're, you know, in Hurricane Katrina, we had situations where, you know, the entire infrastructure of a lot of the public buildings and whatnot were just gone. So it was very difficult to sort of even get the right permissions from the right jurisdictions to be able to come in. And so we in the United States, we at least have some very strict authorities about sort of when those things can be superseded if you're still working in that jurisdictional area. And so in Syria and Turkey, I'm not sure how their legal frameworks are set up, and maybe Andrea, you can speak to that, but it's a jurisdictional issue. The legal framework, it's guided by the legal frameworks of who has authority for law enforcement in that area.
Andrea, I'll ask you then the same question about provision of security.
Yes, once more, I'm happy to let you know that international law has quite clear answers. It's quite unusual, right? Because usually international law is used and misused. But in this case, they are quite clear cut answers. The first answer is who is responsible for the security? The first answer is the local state. And then it's up to the local state to decide which authority, which law enforcement agency, at which level is responsible for the security of both the local population and the international staff. So if the EU, as it happens in these very days, decides to send their civilian staff to support the firefighters and to support the search and rescue teams in Turkey, we know that the responsibility to protect our staff is in the hand of the local authorities. Now, the second aspect, which sometimes is not considered a proper manner, what if we have, and this was something which Brenda was a little bit anticipating, what if due to the circumstances, the local state is unable to provide security, which happens. I mean, you were mentioning Katrina, but it happens very often that simply they don't, it's that they would like, but they simply are unable because they have been suffering consequences. In this case, a totally different rule starts to become relevant, which is being more and more elaborated. It is condensed in the notion of the so-called duty of care of the sending organization who sends someone in a high or critical risk situation. If you do this, and this is the case of the European Union, if you send someone, but it is applicable to all the international organizations and to the states, if you send one of your officers into a situation where the security is not granted by the local state, you have a duty of care. That is to say, you have to adopt all possible measures to mitigate the risk, to prevent the risk. And these possible measures means that you need to have a proper secure a risk assessment done in a professional manner. If needed, you need to ask the local state to accompany with security forces these humanitarian workers. You need to train the humanitarian workers. You need to insure them against any possible consequences, et cetera, et cetera. You might think that this is a little bit fictitious, but I can tell you, because I just finished a big research on this, that the number of civilians working in emergency situations abroad who are bringing their sending organization and sending state in front of tribunals is increasing day by day, because they feel that the state or the organization who has sent them to Turkey, for example, now, or to Syria, even worse, has not done what they were supposed to do on the basis of duty of care, because we have not trained, you did not do a proper security assessment, you do not have a specific agreement with the local state, you do not recruit private contractors or other security forces to guarantee our security. So to sum up, the local state has the main responsibility to guarantee the protection of both the local population and those, the humanitarian workers. If the state is not able to do this, then it is the responsibility of the sending organization to adopt a certain number of measures to mitigate the risk that something unpleasant happens to them.
So now armed with this sort of broad legal, you know, framework, Nukhat Sendal, how effective has Turkey's provision of security in the region be? Are we getting reports out of increased crime and violence? You know, you made the reference to the hate crimes against Syrians within Turkey. What's the report card for Turkey in the region?
There's definitely looting going on, Doug, but my impression is that this is not right now like a huge widespread concern. One interesting development was since Turkey's Disaster Management Authority, AFAD, has been deficient in responses, we have seen the emergence of, not the emergence, but maybe the increasing relevance of some local NGOs. And one of them is, Madonna was actually like, she said that she supports them, is this organization called Ahbap, the Foundation of Anatolian People and Peace Platform, which is led by a famous Turkish rock singer. So Ahbap has actually, people, I saw some reports and polls that people have more trust in Ahbap than Turkey's Disaster Management Authority. So, and this, of course, as you can imagine, led to some controversies. The Turkish Interior Minister, for example, Süleyman Soylu, recently said that they would do like whatever is necessary to prevent any civil society organization that would abuse the government's cooperation with them in relief efforts. So the government, and actually there were also some rumors that the government might take over the Ahbap funds, which is, as far as I know, has exceeded like $50 million right now. There's a lot of support coming from outside, support coming from celebrities, and almost all of the fundraising efforts I have seen in the US actually is supporting Ahbap. So you see this organization, and by the way, we have to remind that Haluk Levent, this rock star who is involved with this organization, has made it very clear that they are not going against state. They are not, they don't have any intention to not support Turkey's Disaster Management Authority. He encouraged people actually to support the official authority, saying that we have received enough support, we don't need any more, because there is a genuine political scare that if this organization becomes too relevant, too visible, how are they going to continue their efforts given the increasing insecurity of AK Party's elite, AK Party's officers? But that is one interesting thing that is going on in the region right now, that these alternative organizations, not the state, delivering the most relief and also being considered the most reliable.
You made references to the AK Party, Nukhat. I'm actually going to return to you because I know that there's a potential political crisis in Turkey. I mean, first of all, there's the elections that are coming up in May, but hearing more and more reports, I had not heard about the earthquake tax. I want to follow up on that question, but I have heard quite a bit about how President Erdogan had been bragging that he got buildings built more quickly because they didn't apply strict standards on, you know, earthquake proofing, et cetera. And such a disaster could certainly, I would imagine, cause quite a bit of political blowback on precisely that. So is the dominant AK Party at risk here?
Yes. And that's a great point, Doug. One of the main lines of AK Party has been how much infrastructure and construction they have provided when during the time they were in power. And actually, it's interesting to remember that the government's slow response to the earlier earthquake played a large part in bringing AK Party to power in 2002. And AK Party and Erdogan promised transparency and rebuild the economy and the structure, the infrastructure. So He has indeed, Erdogan has made construction the core of the Turkish economy. And you even see the importance and relevance of these construction companies abroad, not just in Turkey. They have major roles in sub-Saharan Africa, Southeast Asia, Afghanistan. So actually, I'm working currently on a project that is like, you know, construction has been one of Turkey's soft power tools abroad, like trying to establish relations. And on paper, also, it's really interesting to point out that Turkish safety standards are actually among the strictest and the best in the world. But the problem is the enforcement. I mean, the most of the buildings are concrete, but they are not reinforced properly with steel. And we have seen a lot of pancaking, therefore, like floors stack up on each other. And according to the numbers released by the Environment and Urbanization Ministry 4 or 5 years ago, more than half of the buildings in Turkey violated construction and safety regulations. On top of that, think about the construction amnesties. And this is not an Erdogan problem. This has been going on since the 1960s. Construction companies, when they had lacked safety certification, they could pay a fee. And then the building would still be certified, so the government would get some money. And the latest of which was actually enacted in 2018. And there's a clip of one of the opposition party members talking against that, saying, look, how long are you going to do this? And how are you going to answer to people if a huge earthquake happens and thousands of people die? You cannot just keep extending these construction amnesties. So that, of course, undermined the government's credibility big time, both these amnesties and the biggest promise being construction and infrastructure. And we all know the inflation rates in Turkey and the declining the value of Turkish lira. I mean, the economy is in shambles. So that was not, the polls were tight anyways, even before the earthquake. It would be very tight presidential and parliamentary contest. So this definitely adds to Erdogan's AK Party's problems about in the upcoming elections. That's why like there was briefly a discussion about, well, is he going to postpone? Will he try to postpone the elections? Because under these conditions, it would be a miracle really if he has an easy win in these elections.
You're listening to Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Doug Becker. We're discussing the disaster relief and the consequences of that relief of the massive earthquake that hit Turkey and Syria on February the 6th. Our guests today are Nukhet Sandal of Ohio University, Andrea DeGutri of SSSA in Pisa, Italy, and Brandon Knoll of North Carolina State University. We've been focusing quite a bit on Turkey. I want to spend this last section really focusing on Syria. And Andrea DeGutri, one of the huge challenges in the provision of resources in Syria, actually kind of a dual challenge. One is the government's lack of control over, you know, some of these areas. And so, I mean, so much of international law makes a presumption that there's an entity that's in control. And if there's not, that's a challenge. And then also there's been international sanctions regime against the Assad government in Syria. How much has the ongoing war and some of the human rights abuses of the Assad regime complicating the response and the legal obligations in providing resources to Syria?
It has complicated for sure. For two reasons. One, because obviously nobody or not many states and the U.S. administration has been in the forefront who like to accept any kind of invitation or support in any possible manner officially the Saddam regime, but same position is this position is similar to most of the European Union states. And the second problem is that part of the territory, as you, Doug, were mentioning, is not under the control of the Syrian authorities, because it might be under the control of the Turkish state or of the rebels. Now, as far as the first aspect is concerned, yes, there are complications, but as the US and other European states said, that we will not deny humanitarian assistance, provided that it will be not run through the government. because we don't want to support the government, nor we trust in the government to be able and to be willing to distribute in a fair manner. Fair manner means on the needs based. So whomever needs it most should receive that support. How to solve this problem? It is very difficult because the accessibility is very different. It has been mentioned earlier that so far there has been only one possibility to enter through Turkey. Now they are looking for possible alternatives through Lebanon, which seems to work more or less. And there are ideas, as it has been remembered earlier by Nuket, to open two other streets to come into Syria and occupy territories through Turkey. The question of the sanction, yes, it is true. This is creating additional troubles, but the sanctions usually contain a clause which exempts from the sanction the so-called humanitarian assistance. And therefore, it works exactly in the same manner. But I repeat, the additional problem is how to make sure that this humanitarian aid reaches those who are really very much in need. Now, my last comment concerns those territories which are currently not under the control of the Syrian authorities because they are under the control of the militias or the opposition or the guerrilla, called you the way you want, or they are controlled de facto by the Turks. According to international law, those who have the control in this specific moment have exactly the same obligation as a state. So in this very moment, in Idlis or in the part occupied by Turkey, the authority who are de facto imposing their willingness or exercising government forms have the same obligation as a state. Now, the only problem we see from an international law point of view is if they transform in the future and become an independent states, they will be held accountable for having violated, if this is the case, the rules which expect them to provide the necessary humanitarian assistance to the people living in the territory they are controlled. If they will disappear, the problem of enforcing these rules against someone who is not anymore in charge of that territory will become obviously much more difficult.
And actually, to follow that up, Andrea, a case that immediately comes to mind in what you're describing here was relief after the tsunami in places like Sri Lanka, where international actors were compelled to work with groups of sort of questionable legal and political legitimacy, like the Tamil Tigers. And there were criticisms that you're actually supplying resources to groups that the state considered to be a terrorist organization. Is there a legal obligation on the part of who's providing the resources to work with the local, you know, whoever has de facto control? Because you described it that whoever has de facto control has a legal obligation to request the assistance, but those providing the assistance, do they have to work, you know, with those sorts of actors, or is that pretty much at the discretion of whoever's providing the resources?
This time I give you two different answers, more legal and formalistic, and the one more pragmatic and political. Formally speaking, yes, you can provide your assistance if requested through the local authorities. So you need the consent of the local authorities. If they have the ability to control the territory and they don't want you to enter, they have all the tools to prevent you bringing the necessary foods. We had a few cases. I don't know if you remember the case, for example, of Venezuela, when basically the Venezuelan authorities did not allow, especially the US, but two other states, to provide the humanitarian support to the local population, which was really suffering hunger. What they did in that case was to open refugee camps or humanitarian camps just outside the borders, which is one of the options, which with a lot of negative consequences, because then the Venezuela or the state might have an interest to let them go and then not to let them come back, obviously, for different reasons. So this is for sure the official answer. The more pragmatic answer and what happens in reality, and although most states will deny this, that if this is the situation, the state do not want to have specific relation with a state they don't like or because it's a terrorist state or so-called terrorist state, they try to provide this humanitarian assistance through different forms, trying to get through non-governmental organization or local organization. Sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't work, sometimes it's extremely dangerous for the local NGOs because they might commit a crime again, according to their national legislation, accepting some kind of international financial or support or in-kind support, and therefore they must be very careful. But the international community has become quite sophisticated, and if they want, there are means to make sure to a significant extent that the humanitarian aid can reach those in need. Let me just remember that in similar cases, an alternative to organize these camps outside the country where you cannot enter was to airlift the goods to the region affected, which proved sometimes to be very successful, although there are other negative consequences, but this is one of the options on the table which states have been considering in the past.
Yeah, and Brendan, that kind of raises the question that if you're providing resources to an area that's been affected by a disaster, you have a lot of political power, a lot of social power if you're the ones doing the distributing. Is there a kind of a best practices model? I guess one easy answer is whoever happens to be the government itself. But in the areas that tend to be a bit more lawless, I think of the area after Katrina.
And in general, if you're coming in from the outside to help, there's an onus on those coming in to make sure that help is helpful and not just bulldozing over whatever the existing capability for response is. And so I think, you know, we've seen that and it gets to be a gray line when you're in these catastrophic incidents where there's so little left of the local capacity to even marshal. But I think in general, if you're coming in to help, recognizing that that the more you can sort of integrate in and, you know, and it depends on the phase of the disaster as well. If during the immediate response, when you're working on short timelines for preservation of life, the rules are a little bit different than in debris removal. But I think that as a general rule, recognizing that when you're coming in, you're trying to integrate in as much as possible. If there is something upstanding in terms of there is some sort of governance, and I will use the word governance, not government, because sometimes the governance, like Niket was talking about, it may not be the state, it may be another entity, but trying to plug in and coordinate with that entity in as much way as possible. But I think also just recognizing that, you know, in these large scale catastrophic disasters, like everything is going to be decentralized. Like there is no centralized response that is going to be capable by definition. Like it overwhelmed the centralized response. And so it is going to be a decentralized network response. And so being able to sort of work within those network settings and allowing the tools that make networks function. One of the things I read a report on that was really disturbing news that Turkey shut down Twitter, for example, for a period of time during the response. Twitter can be extremely powerful tool for localized responses that are decentralized for people to coordinate with each other about who needs what, where, and how. And so all of those social media tools, all of those like sort of emergent groups and entities that sort of come online and help to respond, they oftentimes are some of the most important actors in the initial, particularly in that initial phase when sort of preservation of life is the utmost concern and there's a limited time window to do it. You know, really being able to enable as much of that as possible. And because one, it's going to happen anyway. And two, getting in the way of that is just going to hinder and potentially lead to further casualties and loss of life. And so I think that, you know, that's a really, we're seeing that play out here. And we see that on many disasters that hit this kind of scale, where it really is a decentralized response with lots of emergent actors that are not necessarily the state taking key roles and sort of needing to sort of work within that system and recognize that that is the system and to enable the tools that allow that sort of emergent coordination to happen is, I think, really, really critical.
And Niket, we have about 2 minutes left. We've been spending a lot of time sort of analyzing the impacts and analyzing the response. But for all of us who've been watching this, people listening, et cetera, that would like to do something that would be positive to help, do you have any sort of suggestions, places we might want to try to contribute, or, you know, what's the best way we can have a positive impact?
Well, first of all, I would encourage everyone to reach out to friends from the region, Syrian Turkish friends. We all have lost loved ones, friends. And for me personally, and I'm one of the ones lucky and I did not incur like horrifying losses, but it has been really helpful to hear messages of support and solidarity. And second is, of course, like contributions to some of these organizations active on the ground. Ahbap is definitely one of them. And on the Syrian side, as far as I know, White Helmets and Mulham have been doing heroic work, and they are very reliable. I encourage folks to consider and this is one of those things, like every penny matters, contributing whatever they can to one of these organizations. Keep following, because like every news item, this will probably fall off the headlines in a couple of weeks, unfortunately. But the region will suffer from the effects of this earthquake for at least a decade to come.
And we will post links to some of these different groups on scholarcircle.org on our website, you know, if you'd like to contribute and like to follow it up. But that last point Nunkat made, I think, is really absolutely essential, because sadly, I think I'm worried that it's not going to be in a few weeks. This will be pushed from the headlines. It seemed to be pushed from the headlines pretty quickly, considering other issues within the United States. And I think it's essential that we keep paying attention to this case, trying to understand disaster relief, because at the core, I think if we've learned nothing in the last few years, particularly with respect to the pandemic, governments have a responsibility to provide resources, in particular in times of issues of life and death, like what's happened with respect to the natural disaster, you know, to this horrific earthquake in Turkey and Syria. And so being able to improve those responses, I think, are absolutely essential. We've been discussing the massive 7.8 earthquake that hit Turkey and Syria on February 6th, the disaster response networks, the legal framework that governs questions about disaster relief, and the conditions on the ground in Turkey and in Syria. Our guests today have been Nunkat Sandal, Associate Professor of Political Science and the Associate Dean in the College of Arts and Sciences at Ohio University. She's the author of Religious Populist Parties, Nationalisms, and Strategies of Competition, The Case of the AK Party in Turkey, and Religious Leaders and Conflict Transformation. She's also the editor-in-chief of the Oxford Research Encyclopedia of International Studies. Andrea De Guttri is professor of international law at Scuola Superiore Santa Anna, or SSSA, in Pisa, Italy. He's the author of Foreign Fighters Under International Law and International Disaster Response Law. And Brenda Knoll, professor at the School of Public and International Affairs at North Carolina State University. She's the author of Public Management in an Era of the Unprecedented, Dominant Institutional Logics as a Barrier to Organizational Sensemaking, and The Structure of Effective Governance of Disaster Response Networks, Insights from the Field. Thank you all very, very much for joining us.
And that's it for today's program. Thank you for listening. The Scholar Circle is hosted by Doug Becker. Its managing producers are Ankine Agassian and Melissa Chiprin. Seth Dongre is our webmaster and assistant producer. Our archives are at scholarcircle.org, and our podcasts are on Apple and Google Podcasts and iTunes. Please follow us on @ScholarCircle or me @Armudian, and join our Facebook page. I'm the founder, anchor, and occasional host, Maria Armudian.